Okay, good morning. For the few of you that woke up this morning, not many of you woke up, actually, for the jet lag, we can just start with waiting for the people who are late. We can just look for something here. That is just the plan. This is important because you have probably to start looking for your report paper. So this is more or less is the schedule for the next. So we are here, so we are still talking about the lecture, then we will talk about promoters and the interaction and then CR. Then we have the last part that is for part four that will actually concern transcriptome and all the post-transcriptional events that happens, and so we will finish with this regulatory networks. Then on April 29 we will have seminars here for you about circular RNA. And then starting from the 2nd of May you start with the reports. Okay? Don't look at me like that. Second, and then look at the calendar, I don't know. So we will start. I will open choices on the Moodle so you can set your groups and reserve slots. Okay? But the problem why I am talking about this today is because we have 1 month left, and so you start looking for your papers. This is important. Okay? And you go through, there are some rules to look for papers. First of all, the papers should be coherent with what we are discussing today, okay? So even though you may find very interesting paper about, I don't know, neurophysiology or treatment of cancer with some new molecule or whatever else, this has nothing to do with our course, so you have to stick with the general subject that we have discussed in this course, included this post-transcriptional regulation that is the next step. So microRNA, long non-coding RNA, alternative splicing, and all this stuff there, okay? So the rules are that you will concentrate only on the last 2 years' papers. That means either 2017 or 18, or of course 19 at the beginning, okay? And publish it on main journals. Why main journals? Because usually they publish something that is probably more relevant to our course than small journals. So saying important journal, I mean Nature, Science, Cell, Molecular Cell. You can go down until, I don't know, Genes and Development or PNAS, but I put a list on the Moodle site, okay? So you choose on there. All these journals that I told you are available online if you are logged in by a university IP. Okay, so you can download whatever. Okay, and when you have chosen, I make a kind of file on Moodle. So whenever you have looked for one paper, please don't send me 5-6 papers to the site because it's too much for me. You are 40, and if any of you decide for 5 papers, it makes a lot of stuff. So just one select. Then you put on this file that I will open on Moodle site, and I will survey the paper and say you yes, no. Okay? Shortly, but try to start now. So, okay. Other things? No. We are done. Okay. Oh yeah, the reports have to be made in couples. Okay, so 2 of you. Okay, not 3, because when you make a groups of 3, usually there is one that do nothing. and the other one works. If you have two, probably it's better. Not alone, because usually preparing a paper alone is a quite too difficult task. It's better to have somebody to share it. Okay? So, start with the lesson today. Visualizza qua. Okay, we're still on enhancers. Enhancers will keep us busy for all the week. You will be bored about enhancers. So just to say what we did last time, just a very quick abstract of what we have discussed in the last week. We have discussed the human transcription factor repertoire and just the small things that you have to remember, that transcription factors are families, and these families are actually classified on the type of DNA binding domain, as you remember. It's clearly explained in your review textbooks. The most frequent at all is this zinc finger with cysteine and histidine, that here, at least in human, is the absolutely the most represented domain. Then we have discussed the algorithm to find the motifs of DNA which bind the transcription factors, and then we have discussed that many of these transcription factors have cell and tissue specificity. And also another story that is quite important that is written in your review is that 80% of we didn't discuss this last sentence, we can do now, is that the when people did this GWAS, do you know what the GWAS are? Genetic genome-wide association studies, in which I told you when we try to link any kind of disease to a particular variant or mutation, but actually mutation only in cancer, but usually is a variant, okay, in the genome. And 80% of these variants associated to disease are actually in non-coding regions. So this probably enhances the importance of this regulatory region. Anyway, so just to remember you that whenever you have a domain or something that you want to look at, just go to this PDB. You remember this is a database of structures, and here I just choose one of these unfrequent structures. This ATUC is a really low representation in humans. It's something like 12 transcription factors, so 1%. And it's a particular structure that is not alpha helical, it's a stretch of amino acids that, like this one. Anyway, just to start. Okay, so the agenda today is how different and cell type specific enhancer activation, so how they work, how enhancers are selected during development, and then finally we look for enhancer activation. And the, so this is the story. And the content of the lessons today is actually in the other textbook that you have for this part. That is this review article from Sven Heinz and Chris Glass, that are important scientists in the field, and has been published in 2015. Okay. So the first issue is that, as you see in this slide, when scientists explored data from ENCODE, PHANTOM, and other big projects we talked about, conducted in wide range of different cell types and tissues, okay, when they integrated the TFBS, so the transcription factor binding site found in all these different tissues and blah blah, with histone modification and RNA-seq data, so expression data, they could conclude that about 500,000 enhancers exist in the human genome. I told you last time that this is an estimate,
and probably just making a kind of, you know, number of an answer found with the number of transcription factors studied and the number of cells studied, the plateau, estimated plateau, is something like 1 million an answer in the gene. And this, of course, greatly outnumbers the regions labeled as a promoter by a factor that approaches 10. Okay, so we have 10 enhancers each promoter or something like this. So this is the first ENCODE release, and this is the number that they published at that time, was in 2012. And they also found accentuated cell type specific. Okay, so in other words, only a small fraction of these enhancers are either active or marked for activation in each cell type. Saying in other words means that, of course, when you look at all the cell types and all the different transcription factors, whatever, you find a large number. But if you limit your analysis to one single cell type, only a fraction of those is actually an enhancer in that cell. Okay, so this is the cost. So looking at this kind of different, you remember different analyses that were done by this ENCODE and other projects. You remember there is accessibility, Eastern PTMs, and the presence of mobile Eastern isoform like these two, TF binding, the presence of acetyltransferase P300 and CBP we talk about in a minute, and the presence of RNA polymerase in transcription of vRNA. All these subjects will be discussed in minutes. Okay, they could classify this kind of enhancers in classes. Okay, so an enhancer, and when I say an enhancer, means you remember a sequence in which there are several TF binding motif together, okay? They can be either inactive, that means nothing at all, just anonymous sequence in the DNA, or in condition that authors call it primed or poised, and some other make a difference in between the two states, or active, okay? In some review, you see that this primed and poisoned status are actually classified as one single state. In other words, means that a sequence can be not occupied by transcription factor, so just heterochromatic as the rest of the genome, okay, so inactive, or can bring some of these characters that you see here. Some of them, not all of them, together, okay? And you say, okay, this enhancer is ready for activation, but it's not yet active, okay? Or to have all these features together, and in this case, it is active status, okay? This is the destroyer. So we define different functional states of enhancers. Okay. And this is actually the first figure that you find in your textbook, that is this one, in which they compare the status of poisoned enhancers to the status of active enhancers. They don't, in the review there is no illustration about the other status, because just, okay, when it's inactive you don't have any mark, so just nucleosome over it, okay? And when you have primed, means that you have only some of these marks. Okay. So an answer that is poisoned means that the enhancer is ready for activation, but is not active completely. And this poisoned enhancer is featured by several things. So first of all, you have a kind of bivalent status, we discussed it already. So you have nucleosomes that are flanking the region of the enhancer itself, okay? And we call this region a nucleosome-free region, because in this, let's say, 300, 400 nucleotides, there is no nucleosome sitting on it. You find 1, 2, 3, 4, depending on the enantiomer, you find transcription factors for the classification we discuss in a minute. Okay. Then you find several modifications to histones, and as you can see, there are two modifications that are exactly bivalent, as we discussed last week. That is the K27V3, that is a repressive mark, and this K4V1V2, that is actually an activation modification. Okay? Then you can find several enzymes, like this component of the trithorax, the orthologous trithorax complex, that is actually the methyl transferase that methylates K4, so this position. And you find, for example, the PCG subunit is the H2, that is, you remember, a component of the PRC2, okay, that makes this K27. And also, you may find, in some enantiomer, you may find the polymerase 2 bound to it. But as you can see from the label, this is absent or low. That means that actually, in some enantiomer that is still not active, you can find low amounts of polymerase 2. And this probably detects a status of free activation. What are these LDTF and CTF? They are transcription factors that in the review, as you will see probably, or you have seen maybe, the authors classify in different categories. The LD means lineage determining TF. That means that there are transcription factors that are expressed only in a cell-specific way, okay? And they determine the development over a certain time. Neuron, epithelial, fibroblast, or whatever. Okay? So they are cell-specific transcription factors. And this CTF means only collaborating transcription factors. So any other transcription factor that is expressed in that cell and that co-binds the same enantiomer. Okay? So this is the, just to show. The last thing that you see in this slide is NRC, that is nucleosome remodeling complex. Nucleosome remodeling complexes are ATP-dependent machineries that actually help the nucleosome sliding away. Okay? Since you have a nucleosome-free region in between, you need a machine to slide the nucleosomes on the side. Okay? Good. So compare this figure that is poised enantiomer, so enantiomer that is ready but not going, okay, with the active enantiomer. The active enantiomer has fundamentally one modification here, that is this one. So you have no longer methylation to the K27. I go back to the other slide. You see high K27V3, okay. You go to the active K27V3, absent or low. So this mark disappears, okay, and on the contrary, you have very high acetylation to this position. Remember that methylation and acetylation is either one or the other, so they are mutually exclusive, okay? So this is strongly acetylated, okay, and you still have K4, Me1, Me2, the enzymes, okay. This is the histone demethylase, okay. Of course, that brings about this demethylation. You have HAT, that means an enzyme that will acetylate histones, so histone acetyl transferase, okay. And you have another factor that appears, so SDTF, signal dependent TF. So the situation is that you have two factors there that mark in some way the enantiomer in that cell line, okay, the lineage determined TF, but this enantiomer waits for a signal. When a signal arrives, it will activate. And this signal is usually a signal-dependent transcription factor. That means that you have either endogenous signals or exogenous signals, try to translate, that will, of course, add another transcription factor there and start the enhancer activity. Make examples, okay? Endogenous signal. Do you remember? Probably you know the SRBP, sterol response binding protein. Never heard about it? Okay, whenever you have the cholesterol low, there is a factor in the. Never heard about it? In the endoplasmic reticulum that it sits there quiet. So when you have lowering of that, this is cut in two, and one of the parts is a transcription factor that migrates to the nucleus and activates the program to synthesize cholesterol or whatever. Okay? This is an endogenous signal, for example, which is a metabolic signal. Another example of external signal is you have many, as many as you want, steroid receptors. Okay? Hormone, steroid receptor, goes to the nucleus, activates transcription. So this signal-dependent transcription factor means the response that the cell has to do with any kind of story. Okay? So, note another thing, that you have a wider nucleosome free region here, because of course the binding of additional factors, the enhancers. Okay, so widen the nucleosome free region, and very importantly, we'll discuss in a minute, we have this eRNA. So we have this polymerase 2 that is always found in the two sides of the enhancers, and this polymerase actually transcribes. This is a completely novel finding. People started to see that in no more than, say, 10 years ago, maybe less. And this was completely surprised, because everybody, as you know, was convinced that everybody was convinced, that you probably are convinced, that usually the polymerase transcribes from promoters, not from enhancers. But actually, as you will see in a minute, this is the other novel story that was coming from the genome-wide studies. Okay? So this is the... In this review of Lambert, that you remember, there was a division of transcription factor in LTDF, SDTF, and CTF, as you saw before. So these lineage-determining transcription factors are factors that are expressed in a cell-specific way, but there is a note important. Sometimes you have the same transcription factor in two different cell lines. So you may ask why the same lineage-determining transcription factor is expressed in two different lines and will activate different enhancers. Just because it will collaborate with different resident factors. Okay, so you remember the combinatorial rule. Okay, so sometimes you have the same factor, for example, PU1, okay, is expressed both in macrophage and in B cells, but in both of them it activates different enhancer cells just because it collaborates with two different factors that are expressed exclusively in macrophages or in B cells. These are SDTFs, we discussed it already, and this is collaborating transcription factors, okay? That usually are constitutive of ubiquitous TFs that collaborate. Okay. So, in this review, your textbook, there is an example of this specific activation that is looked through analysis of, you see, the trace, the red trace, I imagine you cannot see it. Is that getting any better? A little bit. Can I try to... Ho visto che si può smorzare. Come si fa? Si tiene? Così. Così, maybe. Okay? So there is a red trace here that is the DNA's hypersensitivity. So it's made with using DNA-seq, as you remember. Okay. Then you have a dark green or something like this trace that is the K4 demethylation. Okay. Then you have a light green trace that is the 27-me3. And finally, there you have what is orange trace that is K27AC. Okay. And this is just one piece of the genome where you have a TAL1 and another gene here. And TAL1 is expressed only specifically in B cells. Okay. And in general in erythropoietic cells. Okay. So you see that they analyzed this guy in ESC cells, so stem cells. This is UVEC, is a cells, primary cells taken from umbilical vein. This is a line of lymphoblastoid. This is erythroid. This is muscle myoblast, and this is epidermal keratinocyte, and this is lung fibroblast, so different cell types. And you can follow the state of activation. So whenever you see a high signal of the green here, K27Me3, this one, means that this is completely repressed, okay? But on the contrary, you see that, for example, you have K4Me2, oh, this is blue, okay? K4Me2, you see this signal here and this signal here, means that this this is a something like a promoter, close to the promoter, okay? You see that you have completely inactivation in this line, that is ESC, completely inactivation in muscle, epidermal keratinocyte, and lung fibroblast. On the contrary, you see activation that is written in this K4Me2, okay, in erythroid cells and endothelial cells that have the same lineage in some way, okay? You have other two enhancers here. This is called plus 19 enhancer, and this is called plus 51 enhancer. They both activate transcription of TAL1, even though they are so far away. And you see that the profiles of modification are the same, as you see here. In this erythroid cell, you have activation of this enhancer, plus 51. In the UVEC cell, this enhancer is not active, but you have another enhancer here active. Okay? So that's a story. So they, just to show you different situations, this is just an enlargement of the first four lines. Okay, you see here, here. Okay. And this is the enlargement of the second part of this line, looking for the three enhancers. Okay? So this illustrates to you one case, just taking one gene as a N3 enhancer as an example, but actually was studied, this situation was studied genome-wide. It's quite interesting, okay? And so the question was in this paper that I show you, how enhancer state is determined developmentally. So people from this paper that was published in a few years ago, they on cell. This was a study to try to understand the enhancer dynamics through development. So what they did was to take the mouse. Okay, so they studied these stages from the embryo. So E at 11.5 day, 14.5, 17.5, you know, it is very close to the birth. And then they started P0, so at the birth, then P7, P21, and P56, so different stages in the young age and then adult. Okay? So they took forebrain, heart, and liver. And they ran the typical the typical modification that you see on active enhancers, that is the acetylation of K27. Okay, so cheap experiment on all these tissues in all these developmental stages. and see what happened. Okay, so this is the story. Let's look at an enlargement of this figure, just for making you to appreciate what is this. And these are examples. So they are different enhancers. All these columns refer to different enhancers, okay, that are close to developmentally important genes. Like this enhancer is one that is placed at 14 kb, far away from the SOX11 gene, that is one of the members of the SOX family. This is an answer that is 12 kilobase far from the genes, and this IGF-1 receptor, blah, blah, blah. Just examples, okay? And these are traces that, as you remember, this is a 4 kb window. So each of these columns represents a 4 kb window around the enhancer, okay? And you see the trace of K27 acetylation on this story, okay? So just look at this. You have, for example, this SOX11 enhancer is activated, as you can see, starting from the first embryonal point and reaches a maximum at 14.7, then it goes down, it is still active at the P0, then it goes down, and in the adult it's inactive. Okay? But only, apparently, only in the forebrain, because if you look at the same situation in heart or liver, you see that this enhancer is completely or almost completely inactive, okay, at all stages. You look at this other enhancer gene S here, you see that it's exactly the opposite way around. So it is not active in the embryonal phases, and then it starts to be active at birth, and then it increases activity in the adult. So the other way around. But again, it is only in this forebrain. No signal in the heart, no signal in the liver. Then you can follow. Don't make me describing everything, because examples are just symmetrical. So you have other two enhancers that make the same story in heart, and other one enhancer that makes the same story in liver. Okay, so it's just to show you. Okay, you can, of course, comment that, okay, they took the two examples that are behaving like this just to tell an hypothesis. It's not true, because when you consider all the enhancers, this is a difficult figure, of course. This is, you remember, the heat maps are difficult to see. But just to make your attention to, this is, again, is forebrain, heart, and liver. And these are the stages, okay? Embryonal, birth, and adult, okay? And you can see clearly that this enhancer there are clearly distributed differently. So they are many, many, many enhancers that are completely... they follow the same profile as you saw before in the examples. So this group of enhancers is active here, is inactive in the adult. And vice versa, you have a big group of enhancers that is active in the adult, no activity in the embryo, and you can look through the figure. I mean, it's exactly the same. Okay? So the majority, actually, of the enhancers that they look at behave like this. Okay, so they are tissue-specific and developmental stage-specific. Okay. Can I keep the light like this, or you prefer to have the light back? No opinion. Okay, let's go. So, kind of experiment like this, of course, pose to you to ask a question. How are cell-specific enhancers selected and established? So what happens to this enhancer to select them? Actually, we have two or three considerations that we have to make. The first is that usually in ESC, many enhancers are in ambivalent states. So actually they have two marks. So as usual, and as we discussed it in when we were looking at the chromatin in general, usually in stem cells you have a kind of undecided state. Okay, so you have the two marks. But whenever you make differentiation, so you induce staminal cells to differentiate, you start to see repressive marks with at enhancers, especially to enhancers that control master pluripotency, like for example SOX2, OCTA4, NanoG, and so on. And repressing this TF will also repress all pluripotency gene progressively. So this is one observation. Other enhancers that control lineage-specific gene, on the contrary, lose repressive marks and become over active enhancers. So it means that you have probably some primary factor that is expressed in a cell-specific way whenever the stem cells start to differentiate, that start to select which enhancer to activate and which to repress. Okay? So in your textbook, actually they make two kind of possible mechanisms. That is, you have starting point that is compact chromatin. Okay? You have cell differentiation, you start to have this lineage-dependent transcription factor, okay, that binds to some position here in association or not with other general transcription factors, and they put the enhancer in a primed or poised enhancer activity. So that means to have this kind of acetylation and other marks that you saw before. Then you have a signal that we discussed before, that will bring additional transcription factors there, and then you have the active enhancer. This is the theory. However, there are many cases in the literature in which people actually saw this intermediate passage to not to be detectable. So in other words, you have compact chromatin, and then you have a signal activating in the cell, and you have directly the binding of both lineage-dependent and signal-dependent factors to the enhancer. So apparently there is a group of enhancers that are determined, okay, developmentally, and other enhancers that just depend on the kind of factors that are present in the cells plus the signal. Okay, so the first question is this one. The first question is, how can a transcription factor find the target site when you have a compact chromatin? You remember that this figure doesn't actually depict the true state of a compact chromatin. As you remember, this very many, very, very super organized, like in the fiber and so on. So the question is, how can a factor bind to this compact chromatin and start this kind of differentiation? Okay. People have found a group of transcription factors that have this very special property to be able to recognize the sequence, their TFPS, of course, directly on compacted chromatin. And these are called pioneer factors. There are a number of these pioneer factors that are being characterized today. One family that is very important is this FOX family. For example, we will see some experimental data on this FOXA1. These factors are able to start the chromatin change that bring to the enhancer. Okay. We will see an example shortly that is linked to the response to androgens and estrogen. One possible problem is that this FOX factors as well as other pioneer factors have a very small recognition element. And so people always ask, how can this small recognition element determine specificity? And this is another point that people are trying to understand. Probably the story goes through the cooperative action with other factors that we still don't know completely. So there are many other questions that are not completely understood. First, for example, does future activation of an answer require that the primary factor, so the pioneer factor, to be expressed continuously at all stages? So these factors will prime, in some sense, the enhancer, but do the expression of this factor be obligatory in the following steps? Okay? Actually, this probably is not true, because we know that there are certain pluripotent factors like nano G, SOX, and blah blah, that are actually transiently expressed. So they actually hit the chromatin here and there. They make some modification to here and there enhancer, and then they are not expressed anymore, but this enhancer will survive. So probably because they will start this kind of enhancer priming, and then there are other factors that will bind to them. Okay? So they are probably replaced by other tissue-specific factors. This is very difficult to perform a further analysis on this point, because you have to understand that first of all, you have to work with normal cells that are during developmental stages. And this is always a problem. You can start with ES cells, but then it's difficult to follow. Second, it's very difficult to synchronize. I mean, whenever you hit an embryonal stem cell with a factor, it will be synchronized at the beginning, but then the time for each individual cell will be a little desynchronized. So after a while, you have cells making different things, so you cannot understand anything more. And the final story is that there is accentuated stochasticity of the factors. So some factor is expressed at a high level in one cell and a low level in another one. So it's very difficult to understand. Now people, they are trying to make single cell analysis, but very, very difficult. But anyway, that's a point. So the general theory can be resumed like this one. So you have a completely naive chromatin here, this line means a completely naive chromatin. And then you have very primary factors, for example, octa-2 or nano-G or whatever, that will hit points in different points of the chromatin, okay, and making a mark. This mark may be any of these histone acetylation or whatever, or methylation that you have seen before. And the primary factor can stay bound or not to this mark. And then you have additional factors binding to those, okay? So this is a progressive differentiation of active enhancer in itself. Okay? But the concept is that tissue-specific or induced factor bind to pre-marked enhancer and activate transcription for neighboring genes. This is the story. Okay? This is another... Can I skip it? Sorry. Anyway, it tells you the same story. So finally, in this classification that you found, is sometimes you can get confused, because in different articles the people they use different names from the factors. So in this story you have pioneer factors, tissue-specific factors, and signal-dependent factors. In the review that you have as a textbook, they call pioneer factors, and then they call it as a lineage determining factor, but don't be confused about it. It's the same, okay? Okay, we can make an example now that is taken from one subject that I know more, so that is the steroid receptors, okay? And for steroid sex hormones, such as estrogen and androgens, it has been proposed the model, quite interesting, in which the pioneer factor FOXA1, in collaboration with, of course, with tissue-specific transcription factors, marks the enhancers that will be activated by receptors of hormones, okay? So by the estrogen receptor alpha and androgen receptor. When you make a chromatin immunoprecipitation study of YAR-alpha in breast cancer cells or androgen receptor in prostate cancer cells, you have several thousands of binding sites through the genome. Okay, so there are really, okay, I don't tell you the number just because it depends on the depth of analysis. Some people have made medium depth analysis and found something like 7,000 sites. If you make deeper analysis, you can find up to 2 times, so like 15,000 or so. This is difficult to judge. Anyway, there are many thousand sites all around the gene. And almost all of them are actually distant in respect to the regulated genes. So they are, most of them, 98%, they are really distant enhancers. No promoter enhancers. Okay? Good. Just to show you quick remind to how this nuclear receptor work, probably all of you know very well, but anyway. You remember they are cytoplasmatic, mostly cytoplasmatic receptors, that they stay in complex with each shock proteins in the cytoplasm. When the hormone arrives, and you remember that the hormones are lipophilic, so they just diffuse, no membrane receptor, they just diffuse to the cell, they bind to the nuclear receptor, they will dissociate HSP, then the nuclear hormone receptor will dimerize, dimer here, and this dimer is able to go through the nuclear pore because it has a nuclear localization signal, and then it goes to the hormone response element in specific enhancers, okay, where it will, through different coactivators and polymerase, blah, 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 will activate target genes. These nuclear receptors are one of the classes of transcription factor that have been most studied ever. And why? It's simple to say. Just because the pharmaceutical companies are interested in, because they are ligand-dependent transcription factor, okay? Hormone-dependent transcription factor, ligand-dependent. So it means that you can manipulate it chemically, the ligand, and have different actions of these receptors. You can make antagonists, you can make agonists, you can make more potent agonists, less potent antagonists, blah, blah. So you can make drugs, and this is the reason why they have been studied so much, because pharmaceutical industries pay for that, so they studied a lot. We have many, many crystal X-ray images of almost all of the nuclear receptors, and we have a lot of literature depicting how they work and blah, blah, blah. Okay, and there are many, many drugs that are used for, like tamoxifen in breast cancer, this glutamide or bicalutamide for prostate cancer, this thiazolidinediones for peroxisome proliferative activator receptors in diabetes, dexamethasone, that is one of the most common drugs ever. Dexamethasone is also in the decrease for whatever, anti-inflammatory drug, for a very large drug, and it targets glucocorticoid receptors. So there are many, 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 many. So this nuclear receptor is a quite big family. They have different types that are these so-called classical or steroid receptors for all the sex steroid hormones, okay? Or these pure nuclear receptors, so they stay always in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm, that are tidal hormone receptors, retinoic acid receptors, vitamin D3 receptor and peroxisome proliferator receptors and others. And then there is a small class of orphan nuclear receptors in the sense that they have no ligand. And you say, why you put no ligand transcription factor together with the ligand dependent ones? Just because of the structural similarity. Okay, so we have different factors that are, let's say, orphan. In Homo sapiens, we have 48 non-nuclear receptors. Okay, this is the structural organization of nuclear receptors. They have an N-terminal domain that is a transactivating domain, so it interacts with the basal machinery. Okay, this DNA binding domain, this domain C, then just a hinge, and then the ligand binding domain. This is one of the few cases of transcription factors in which the second domain here that interacts with the transcriptional apparatus has been crystallized. Okay, I told you that in general the transactivation domain has not fixed structure. So this is the DBD. The DBD is a zinc finger, not of the C2H2 class, but of the C4 class. Okay, a little different. And this is the LBD, that is, the structurist call it a three-layer alpha sandwich, because it's all alpha in three layers. And the ligand, whatever it is, hormone, whatever, stays in this pocket. Okay. How it works, this is the N-terminal transactivation domain, this is the DNA binding domain, this is the ligand binding domain. Okay, and this is the inhibitory protein, HSP. Steroid hormone receptor, they stay in the cytoplasm, bound to this heat shock protein through this interaction here, COOH interaction. Then whenever the ligand arrives, it binds to this pocket, and this changes the structure of the ligand binding domain, so that the HSP is released and the receptor dimerizes and go to DNA. Okay? And in DNA, it works by binding coactivator proteins. We will discuss coactivator proteins on next Wednesday. Okay, so this is the story, to make the story short, and the ligand is there. Just note that in this figure, and the C-terminal helix has a structure like this in this figure, and then when you go there, you see that this has turned on the ligand binding domain, like a lead. And this is not an imagination of the people who made this draw, but it's reflected exactly in the structure of the ligand binding domain. This is the ligand binding domain of some of the receptors. They are all the same structure, so don't worry if they are to the receptor or under the receptor. They are very similar to each other. And as you can see, this is a three layers of alpha helix, and this is the binding site. Then if you turn by 90 degrees, you see something like this. Okay, this is the hormone. And what happens during activation is that this three-layered domain, okay, here, okay, has the C-terminal helix like this, so it's in open conformation, okay? And when the ligand goes in the pocket, this alpha helix will close the site. You see that? This is turned on, and this closes the pocket where the ligand sits. Okay? So it's a very nice story about the ligands. So the fact is that this surface here is the one that is involved in co-repressor binding. So whenever it's like this, no coactivator here. When you have this situation, coactivator will bind. So the transcription will be activated. You see that in the next lesson. So this is also the reason why if you change the stereospecificity of the ligand, you may place this helix a little different, and so you can change the affinity and specificity of the coactivators. And actually, pharmaceutical industries has made a lot of thought in experiments on this kind of stories. All the coactivators that binds to here have a have a common feature. They have a motif, an amino acid motif that is this LXXLL that is preceded and followed by a charged amino acid. Okay, so actually, in this image, you see again the LBD. This is a PPR gamma LBD. You see this green is one monomer, and this blue is the other monomer, because always they are dimers, okay? Always dimers. And people who realized that this crystal co-crystallized the LBD with the ligand, this is the ligand, they co-crystallized with a small peptide, that is this yellow one, that is taken from a coactivator, this SRC1 coactivator, okay? And you can clearly see that this sticks exactly to the region of the terminal alpha helix that I told you before. Exactly there. And this is the LXXLL motif that I told you. Okay. Good. So just to something about the hormone receptor, why I told you about this story, because we have a very nice story here that is that we take back the theory that, then I stop, but just to tell you the end of the story, to pose the question, then I leave you going for a coffee. Okay, we told you that we have pioneer factors marking the enhancers, okay? And in the experiments that I told you about, the binding of estrogen or androgen receptor to their enhancer requires priming by FOXA1, okay? So you should have the presence of FOXA1 to render estrogen receptor or androgen receptor able to interact with the enhancers, okay? So one question is, if you think about this, you can imagine that the residence time, that means the time that each molecule of FOXA1 spend on this enhancer, should be very long, because it waits for the signal arriving, okay? Probably you think this way. I also told you this way before, okay? So, the story is, do transcription factors reside at an enhancer for such a long time? In other words, is the situation of priming something that is static? Okay, so you have this protein bound to chromatin, they stay there forever, or until the next differentiation of the cells or whatever. And especially, is residence time of pioneer factors really longer than the other signal-dependent factors? Because, of course, when you have a signal-dependent factor like the estrogen receptor, you say, okay, there is a stimulus, this receptor will bind, but then when the stimulus stops, there's no longer a stimulus, I have to dissociate it. So, shorter residence time. Okay, can I leave you with this question? Then we see which kind of experiment people have done to try to answer this question. That is interesting. Okay? This is good because I have to activate some movies. So let's say 10 minutes. Okay, so the question was how to study the residence time of transcription factors to a binding site. Okay, so this is the story, and actually this requires single molecule imaging, of course, because you cannot manage differently than this. Okay, you have to find a way to see with a confocal microscope in living cells dynamics, and to follow this molecule going through a site and standing there and calculate the site. There is no other way. Can you imagine another way to address this point? It's quite difficult, of course. Yeah. So one probably natural way to go through is to make GFP fusions, because you probably know all these GFP proteins that people use for everything, right? Well, the problem is that the GFP in the nucleus is not really good, and also it has a lower signal, low signal, not enough to see real single molecule going to the story. And so biotech companies have developed another way that is quite interesting, that is this allotag. You never heard about allotag? You don't. Okay, allo is a bacterial protein. It's actually a bacterial enzyme, small. It makes 297 residue peptides. It's a small 33 KD. Hello. 1, 2, 3, 4 of you, three of you. Okay, I was just explaining how this kind of residence times is done. And I was saying to your colleagues that we need a single molecule real-time system to see the molecule sitting down the DNA and to calculate how many seconds or minutes or hours stands there and then goes away. So I was saying the GFP is not good for that. So people use this allotag. Allotag is a protein, bacterial protein, that actually has the property of binding to chloroalkane linker. So whenever molecule has an alkane, you know what is alkane? And then a chloro at the end of the alkane, it will bind to it, and then with a quick and covalent reaction, it covalent attaches to that. Okay, this is the allotag property, is that one. Okay, so whenever molecule has a alkane chlorine, it will covalently bind to this tag. So this is quite convenient because you can use an expression vector, so you have your protein of interest, like transcription factor, for example, okay, that you want to study. Okay, so you have the cDNA of your transcription factor of interest, and you fuse in frame with this allotag protein. It's that the same process that you make with GFP, no? Nothing else. Okay. Then when you transfect this allotag vector in the cell expresses this fusion protein with the allotag, and then you give any kind of fluorescent probe to the cell, which is derived with the allotag. Have you understood? No, you didn't understand. Okay. You have the cells expressing allotag fused to your protein, okay? In the cell, okay? Then you give fluorescent probes whenever you like. You choose it for that. There are many, okay? That are a fluorescent molecule attached to alkane chlorine. Okay, can you follow me? This fluoro tag will diffuse in the cell, and as soon as the tag will bind to it, it covalently attaches to it. So you have in vivo labeling of a pre-expressed fusion protein. And this is extremely efficient. People are using it for many, many different stories, like protein-protein interaction, all these stories, localization of proteins, whatever, because you can make very highly intense fluorescent colors. You can choose whenever, okay? Whatever, okay? So this is produced to hit, and with this allotag, people have studied single molecule dynamics in cells, okay? This is one of the first experiments people did with this. Is a paper in Cell from Chen et al. In 2014 that measured actually the SOX2 factor tagged, okay, in I don't remember which kind of cell. This is a nucleus, and you can clearly see the spots. Each spot is a single molecule binding to enhancers, okay, and you can calculate the residence time of each spot, because this is in vivo, okay. I show you a movie to convince you that this is possible.
Okay? Can you see the screen now?
Okay.
Sorry for that. Okay, these are milliseconds. Have you seen that? Oh my God, this stupid story. Can you see this? I can stop it if you want. Non so perché si chiude. Voi avete un'idea di questa schifezza perché si chiude? No? Proviamo a far così, vediamo se funziona meglio. Ok.
You can see that there are...
Again, then fine, basta. Ancora una volta, poi basta.
Okay, so you have spots, okay, that are, you can calculate for each spot the residence time in a particular point, okay? So, of course, it's not you to calculate, of course, you make analysis of all the image and you can calculate.
I show you another story, wait. Now, let us coming to the steroid problem.
You remember that we started our consideration talking about pioneer factors and steroid receptors. I mean, 10 minutes ago we were discussing this point. Is FOXA1 necessary for making steroid receptor landing on enhancers? And the second question is, is the residence time of FOXA1 a long residence time as compared to the signal dependent factor? Okay, so these guys there studied this this story, the dynamic chromatin transition, with the same kind of method that we have just looked at before. There is one movie here, so they expressed halo tagged FOXA1 and allo target estrogen receptor, if I remember well. And you see this movie here. Okay. This is better probably than the other one. Yeah. Okay. This is much better than the other one. So you see, try to follow one point. Try to concentrate to one dot. Look at the moving and concentrate on one single dot and try to imagine how many seconds stays there. Do it again. I mean, to appreciate, you have to concentrate on a single dot. It's fantastic, isn't it? I found it fantastic. Incredible. But,
Sally? In the sense that...
You observed this movie and you have seen essentially two kinds of situations. I think that you appreciate. There are dots that you can count for seconds. I don't know which one you saw, but some of them is something like 8 seconds lasting, the other one is 10 or something like this. And then there are other dots that are really quick. They appear and disappear, quick, 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 quick. So you have two categories of interaction between, because of course if you don't have interaction with a DNA, you have to imagine that the chromatin is quite stable in the nuclei, while the factors, of course, they are single molecule, when they are not bound to DNA, you cannot trace them. It's just a buzzy story around, okay? And so you have interactions that are transient, very transient. Binds and go, binds and go, binds and run, okay? And others that have a permanence time on the enhancers, okay? And you can calculate. So the people actually took the story
and started to calculate all the story there. And what you can do, sorry, I go back to this image and then we change. Okay, so you can calculate this kind of events that are, as you can see in the graph here, if you look at this on the right side, okay, you have that whenever you have they express that SOX2 only detects that is the transcriptional activating domain. Okay, so no DNA binding. Okay, so this is a kind of negative control of this factor. This has nothing to do with the FOXA1, but just to show you the kind of result. Okay, so this is a very, very, very quick permanence time. So this kind of transcription activated domain actually probably interacts with other factors, but this is a non-productive interaction, just touch and run, and then you have very short residence time. On the contrary, when you have this SOX2 complete factor with two components, that is the complete factor, you see that the time increases, but you still have dots that have a good time of residence, that is on average 12 seconds, and other dots that are the ones that you appreciated, hit and run, 0.8 seconds. Means the same, actually the same permanence time that the other ones that were unspecific. So in other words, you have contacts that are unspecific. Hit and run. Then you find the situation, an answer in which probably you have already some marks there or something, or it's open, or you can recruit two factors together, or co-activate or whatever, and then you have factor sits down, makes whatever it is supposed to do, okay, and then run away. Okay, please note that the time of residence is very low anyway. It's very contrary to what you can imagine. A cell that differentiates, okay, so takes time, hours, days, or whatever, and then it marks an answer, and you can suppose that this pioneer factor stays there for days or hours or whatever. Completely contrary. This factor of having a protein in the answer is a highly dynamic. Okay, even when you have this kind of stable interaction, you still are in seconds time of residence. Now, come to the final question that was, is pioneer factor more resident than a signal-dependent factor? So let's go back to the results that I told you. So ER and FOXA1, they studied those glucagon receptors or steroid receptors together with the pioneer FOXA1. And when you look to this, okay, this is a resume of the results. So what you have to see is that the white section is unbound, so the fraction of the proteins that are not bound. The first fraction, the green one, is the one that you saw, like hitting and run. Okay, so how many dots are really very unstable? Okay, and this small slice is the fraction who have residence times like 10 seconds or whatever. So this is a allotagged FOXA1. Untreated means that you didn't put estrogen in the system. Okay. So you have a background, the cell expresses estrogen receptor and FOXA1, but there is no stimulus. So the estrogen receptor is not supposed to go massively to the enhancers. Okay? And you see that the fraction of FOXA1 have an average time of 10 seconds, so it's quick as the other factor before, more or less, 10 seconds of residence time, and the number of hits are just random. Hit and run. Okay, then look at what happens when you have you can add estrogen. Okay, adding estrogen to the cell means that a large fraction of the cytoplasmatic estrogen receptor goes to the nuclei and probably will co-bind with the FOXA1. This is the theory, at least. Okay, so is this
estrogen receptor going to the nucleus, increasing, decreasing, or whatever the residence time? More or less the same. Okay, the fraction of hit and run is more or less the same. The fraction of stable, let's say stable, relatively stable hits is more or less the same, and the time of residence is more or less the same, even maybe quicker than this one. Okay? Good. Look now at the estrogen receptor. So when you express an allo-target estrogen receptor, you can see the same story. Okay? Again, untreated, so no estrogen in it. A small fraction of estrogen receptor actually goes nuclear because of different factors. The estrogen receptor is sufficient to be phosphorylated to go to the nuclei instead of ligand. Okay, so a small fraction of estrogen receptor, as you can see, goes to nuclei, 2.9, and has an intermediate residence time, as you can see. So the residence time of estrogen receptor is a half or something, or a little quicker than the FOXA1. When you give estrogen, massive nuclei translocation of all the estrogen receptor, okay, and so you have a higher fraction of stable binding, and the time increases, as you can see, to 4.3 seconds average, you arrive to 12 seconds more or less. So in other terms, the co-binding of FOXA1 with estrogen receptor increases the stability of the complex. And this is this is a result that is made with single molecule observation, of course, but it corresponds to what we actually studied last time, so that the cooperativity of the factors actually increases the stability of the complex to the enhancers. And close the parenthesis. Anyway, the time of residence is really, really very low. So we have to imagine, as a conclusion, we have to say that the either pioneer factor or signal dependent TFs are actually the residence time is very short. Anyway, okay. So seconds, you can measure in seconds. Of course, when you have two or more components, of course, this will increase the number of foci and also slightly increase the resident times, as you have seen. But in any case, this model devises a highly dynamic interplay between transcription factor and target sites. Exactly the opposite as fixed stories and whatever. Anyway, good. So this is a piece of work, and then we can stop for residence time and go through the third part of the review that you have, that discusses how this activation is brought on. Okay, so the enhancer activation is usually require many other proteins than the ones that you saw on the slides before. So you can have these marks and so on. You need to have this mark and blah, blah. But there are several components that are defined co-regulators that actually are needed to make an enhancer active. And among the others, you have to acetylate, okay? This P300, for example, is a huge protein. 300 means 300 kilodaltons. It's a huge protein. And has an homolog that is called CBP, and binds several transcription factors, and is considered an essential mark for enhancer activity. Among other proteins that are found to enhance, there is the mediator, and other proteins that are actually have enzymatic roles in the locus. So, as I told you at the beginning of the story, we have discovered something very interesting. A few years ago, we discovered that actually there is transcription at the enhancers, okay? So whenever you have a complete enhancer, it will complete in the sense that all the factors required are bound to it, You can recruit coactivators, enzymes, and whatever, and then the polymerase. Okay, and then you will have phosphorylation of the CTD of the polymerase. Do you remember what is the CTD of the polymerase? You don't. Yeah, the polymerase has carboxy terminal repeat, and these are serines that are phosphorylated in different stage of the polymerase start. Okay, and this will start to make Pol2 eRNA. They are called eRNA. E stands for, of course, for enhanced RNA. Okay. So this this production of eRNA is today is considered an essential mark for enhanced activation. It was discovered and published for the first time in 2010, and by the way, not by a molecular biologist, but by a neurobiologist. This is quite strange. But they were studying activation of neurons by potassium chloride, that, as you know, it changes the voltage on the membrane and will induce a transcriptional response. Okay, so they used primary neuronal cultures to elevated levels of potassium chloride, and this gives increase of intracellular cancer level, as you know, and this will lead to changes in gene expression. Okay, so how did they do? I mean, they just started to work with, of course, with classical. I don't have the sorry, I don't have the slide. They started to look for enhancers, okay? And so they started to make chipsec of all the story that you saw before. So K27 and acetylated and P300 and blah, blah, blah. And then finally, they made RNA-seq. But when they started to make RNA-seq, they just wanted to characterize the expression. Okay, so they run RNA-seq to the purpose of understanding what was the relation between activation of enhancer and the cognate gene induced. But then when studying genome-wide story, they realized that actually at the enhancer there was transcription. So they see a small signal of RNA-seq in the surrounding of enhancers. Okay. And this is the graph showing you the story. Okay, so this is they characterized the enhancer through the binding of CBP, that is this acetyl transferase that I told you before. And so this is the center of the enhancers, and this is a window of -2 to +2, so 4 kb around the enhancers. Okay. And this is actually the map of RNA that they detected. So this is, as you can see, this F stands for forward, so the transcription in that sense. Okay. By RNA-seq, you can distinguish sense transcription from antisense transcription. Okay. So this is forward transcription, and this is reverse transcription, so F is in black and reverse is in red, and minus KCL and plus KCL means no activation and activation. Okay, so if you look at the trace, when you have minus activation here, you have this black line here, and when you look at minus activation on the reverse trend, you have this red line here. So no transcription. When you activate, okay, so when you put KCL, you have this line of activation in the anti-strand and this line of RNA seq reads on this right side here. So what can you see from this slide is that they are short. These RNAs are apparently short in the sense that they are something like 1 kilo, so 1,000 nucleotides, or maybe some of them 2,000, and no longer than that. So they're quite short. And they are both sense. So this is a very different mask of what happens usually to promoters, in which transcription is one side. It's not from both. So apparently the RNA polymerase binds to there and then indifferently goes right or left, okay, and makes short, very short RNA, like this. The second question is, are they polyadenylated? Because the first question, whenever you see transcripts, you have to ask if they are polyadenylated or not, means correctly processed as messenger RNA or not. And as you can see, the fraction of polyadenylated, so if you make a poly-A plus preparation of RNA and then look for RNA, you see that you have some, okay, polyadenylated around, but it's not a peak, it's just like a noise all over, so it's the same all over. And actually, it doesn't increase that much from stimulus and minor stimulus, yeah, more or less the same level. So anyway, you can interpret this experiment saying, okay, they are not polyadenylated. Okay. Actually, these authors reported that the expression of this enhancer RNA is very, very low as compared to the average of protein coding gene. Okay, so it's something like one out of 100, so very, very low. And the problem is that actually these enhancer RNA are very unstable since they are not polyadenylated. So they are transcribed and degraded as soon as they are transcribed. So permanence is very low. What they found this in this paper, they also found that the enhancer RNA are induced after stimulation, and you have seen the figures. And also that eRNA are quantitatively correlated with enhancer regulated messenger RNA. So if you compare for each single enhancer the level of transcription of eRNA, okay, and you look for the gene that probably is regulated by that enhancer, the two levels, the level of messenger RNA and the level of eRNA, are correlated. So linearly correlated, okay? So in other terms, apparently the production of eRNA is actually a symptom of enhancer working on the promoter. Okay? In other words. Okay, the eRNA transcription was confirmed after that paper by many other studies, including ENCODE, of course. There is a good description of all these eRNA in the paper of ENCODE that was, you remember, among the 30 papers published in 2012, and this is the author that published the study. eRNA are very unstable, and this makes also a problem that when you use a common RNA-seq technology, you usually don't see them. Almost don't see it. I mean, if we take a normal depth RNA-seq in the lab, we actually have many experiments in our lab, we look for eRNA, you cannot detect them. It's too low. The level is really almost undetectable. Okay? But you can make experiments for that. Okay? There are a special technology, I don't know if you know this, GrowSeq, that actually measures only the nascent RNA molecules, and in that case you can see the eRNA in a good way. Okay. Probably somebody worked out GrowSeq in the Wikimedia. Yeah. So. You label the RNA during transcription, so just measure that fraction of RNA. So mainly poly A minus, so they don't have the story. And there is an important question of what they do. I mean, is just the transcription of eRNA is just a symptom of having RNA polymerase there around, or as a function? This is an important point, I mean, because I stop for a moment and make you thinking about. Of course, we know that the enhancer work with promoters by looping, right? Okay, good. So remember always that when I make a chip sync, I fix with formaldehyde. Okay, so I have my enhancer, I have my promoter, they will join together to make transcription, then I fix them with formaldehyde. So it's very easy to find polymerase close to the promoter or close to the enhancer. Okay, the polymerase is there, and maybe that sometimes it transcribes the RNA, the gene, and sometimes it transcribes just for error. The enzyme is there, sometimes it makes an error and transcribes a little bit also the enhancer that is in the surrounding. Or, does enhancer RNA have a role in the activation of promoters? It's a little different story, okay? So this is an important problem, and it is still unresolved. I mean, we still don't know exactly. There are many cases in which they saw, for example, that one of these eRNA can make a bridge in between the promoter and the enhancer by interacting with proteins. Okay, I show you an experiment next time, not today. Another story is that you can probably try to answer this problem by knocking down the RNA. Okay, so it's the common way when you have something that you don't know what happens. You can knock down the molecule and see whether the phenomenon is still there. So there is one paper here that is again on estrogen, so you can follow the story this morning. Okay, so you can ask exactly that one story. Okay, they just made estrogen treatment of cells, okay, then make a Grossek. So they look it for enhancer eRNA, okay, and they look it for knocking down some of them and looking if the gene associated to the enhancer was still induced or not. I say that again. Okay, you make estrogen to the cell, and you will have some genes that will be activated transcriptionally. Okay? Gene, protein coding gene. Okay? Good. If you make Grossek in the same condition, you characterize enhancers, and you characterize eRNA from enhancers. Okay? Then you choose one couple, like one enhancer that is activated, that is close to a gene that is activated also. You try to knock down the eRNA coming from this enhancer and ask whether the gene itself is still activated or not. Okay? So they managed to do it. And this is just to show you how many eRNA are activated in response to estrogen. Okay, so this is the common, now you have learned how to evaluate this. This is in many, 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 many locations in the genome. And these are reads that are mapped in a 1 kb window around the center of the enhancer. Okay? And this is sense strand, and this is anti-sense strand, RNA. Okay? And this is minus estrogen plus estrogen, minus estrogen plus estrogen. So as you can see, in general, the transcription of enhancer RNA increases after estrogen, and this was expected, of course. Okay, in many, many, many locations. Then there are locations in which this phenomenon is more intense, phenomenon in which the phenomenon is less intense, blah, blah. So they choose two of the top locations there that were connected with genes, okay, and they use it siRNA to abrogate, to knock down eRNA in a couple of doses. This is TFF1 enhancer that is typically one of the most studied estrogen-dependent genes, in the sense that whenever you give estrogen, you have an increase like several times of transcriptions. Okay, so this is the enhancer RNA. And this is the messenger RNA of the gene that is connected to the enhancer. Okay? And you see that whenever you make knockout, okay, with this is Sirna control, that is an unrelated oligonucleotide. Okay, so you have the response. And then when, if you make sirna, so if you knock down the enhancer RNA, okay, this is the enhancer RNA that goes down, okay, then you look for messenger RNA, so you have control plus estrogen minus estrogen. If you downregulate the enhancer RNA, no more response. In other words, the messenger RNA is no longer induced when you knock down the enhancer RNA. Yeah? Same story here. They repeated the experiment because the siRNA are quite inefficient in the nucleus to knock down RNA in the nucleus. So there is an technical alternative that is using this LNA. LNA stands for locked nucleic acids. They have a chemical modification to the both sides of the nucleic acid that make them much more stable in the cell. Okay? Why we don't use always? Because they are most expensive. But this is just the same. And as you can see, they are more stable, and they repeated the experiments, and it's the same. So this is the induction. Control induction by estrogen, and when you knock down the enhancer RNA, no more response. So these authors concluded that enhancer RNA have a functional role in the activity of enhancers. Okay, but problem is that many other authors do not agree with this. Probably it's the last one. So many others do not agree with this. There are many other experiments saying not exactly the same story. Just to tell you that this is an open question. So we still don't know exactly how they work and if they are really important in the term of activation of patients. Good. So this is the last slide. So if you have questions, please. Otherwise, we finish today. Tomorrow we will see this kind of looping. Okay, so tomorrow, not tomorrow, on Wednesday we will discuss the looping and answer problems. Okay, there we go. You have bioinformatics now?